All right, as you continue to enjoy your meal and a cup of coffee, tea, or some dessert, let me just say a great big welcome to each of you for taking time out of your busy schedules to come over to the Christian Embassy and to be in our house. We're honored that you would honor our invitation. For some of you, this is your first time to be here at the Christian Embassy and to be part of what has become for us an annual fall series that we do to serve the diplomat community. And let me tell you just a little bit about Christian Embassy and who we are and what we do. First of all, I'd have to say that we are here really to serve and to serve you as diplomats, as you serve both your respective countries as well as the broader agenda of the global needs of the world that you address every day. And to serve you in a way that perhaps nobody else is, or at least very few are, and that is to bring some resources to the table, to bring some resources to your lives personally that might not be offered through any other means during your term of service here at the UN. To bring some spiritual resources to the table. And we do know that this is part of what this coming series is all about. We do know that at the heart of all service and public policy is a basic understanding about God and about creation. And so that out of philosophy and understanding of God come the policies and the programs that this very important institution provides to help meet the needs of the world. And so if out of our individual hearts are going to flow these important decisions and policies that affect the lives of millions, we feel that taking into account perspective of who is God and what is my role as I serve under him, what does that look like? We feel that if we can provide in some small way a deeper understanding of what it means for you to be not only a public servant but a servant of God while you're here, then we have fulfilled our mission. We do this in a variety of ways, and some of you have attended already the annual prayer breakfast held every opening day of General Assembly in the Delegates' Dining Room. We also provide various venues throughout the year for you to consider this person of Jesus. The ideal time for us to do that usually is Christmas, because that's one of the singular Christian holidays, and also Easter. And so we do hold some special events around those holidays, which provide a special opportunity to consider the importance of the claims of Christ and what that might have to do with why we are all here. And so through these regular forums and other things, we seek to bring some resources to your disposal that we trust will help you to live a fuller life and be a more faithful servant of God in your respective places of calling. I would like to request that each of you, and I know probably half the room has been here in previous studies, so you're not new to us, but we would like, in any case, for everybody to fill out one of the personal information cards so that we might keep you informed of future opportunities and we might have up-to-date personal information. So up-to-date is the key word for those of you that have been here before. We tried a couple of your cell phones and they're no longer functional. So we know that emails change and cell phones change and a lot of things change. So for those of you that have been here before, go ahead and fill out one of those personal information cards. And also, if you're new, we'd be pleased to have your contact information so that we might keep you better informed of these and other opportunities. All right. You probably wouldn't be here if you hadn't received this little invitation either in the mail or by an email. And so you know basically why you're here. This is the launch of our fall series. And the title of this five-session series is Your Worldview Really Matters. It is my privilege to introduce to you today a gentleman who's going to be our resident professor for these five sessions. Dr. Udo Mittelman is currently lecturing at the King's College here in New York City. He is a distinguished scholar and author, has written a number of books, two of which we have copies of and you may purchase afterward today if you would like. Much of the material that he'll be drawing on during these lectures is contained, well, in both books actually, but drawn especially from the book entitled Christianity Versus Fatalistic Religion and the Alleviation of Poverty. Christianity and Fatalistic Religion and the Alleviation of Poverty. Dr. Mittelman is, as I said, a professor and author, a philosopher, a theologian, holds degrees in law from the Freiburg University in Germany and from the Covenant Theological Seminary in St. Louis, Missouri. He has lectured widely on ethics and society in many countries all over the world. He regularly publishes the cyber newsletter Footnotes, where he encourages thinking deeply about matters of faith. I've mentioned one of the books, two of the books actually, that he has authored. Dr. Mittelman lives with his wife, Deborah, in Switzerland, where he is also the president of the Francis Schaeffer Institute, or rather, Francis Schaeffer Foundation, excuse me. And I want to say just a word about Francis Schaeffer. Dr. Francis Schaeffer, a man who is now deceased, but who for probably 40 or 50 years was just a faithful servant of God and had a particular passion to help young people think through the issues of life that really matter. And I don't know Dr. Mittelman's first encounter with Dr. Francis Schaeffer, but I do know one thing. It changed his life because he married Dr. Francis Schaeffer's daughter. And so he has been blessed to not only be connected with Dr. Schaeffer philosophically, and I would have to say that Dr. Udo Mittelman has become one who has sought to perpetuate the legacy of a great teacher and philosopher and leader, Dr. Francis Schaeffer. I was personally impacted by this teaching as a young student in the university days. I had been questioning the validity of this Christian faith. I grew up in it, but I was challenging it, as many students do of everything, right? And one of the first books I read as someone who became a serious seeker after truth was a book by Dr. Francis Schaeffer entitled The God Who Is There. And then shortly after that, I'm not going to remember the other book. What was one of Schaeffer's earliest books?
Escape from Reason.
Those two books were foundational in helping me shape my view of the world. Well, enough about Francis Schaeffer. We've got with us today a man who has much to share with us about how important it is, your worldview, and how that really does matter. So let's welcome Dr. Udo Mittelman on the topic, The Danger in Religion.
Thank you very much. I feel very honored to be invited into your midst, and hope that you're giving up your lunch hour, not your lunch, you've had that, to be here is a great privilege, and I appreciate that very much. To add just a brief bit to the introduction. As was said, I have a degree in law and then in theology. I am presently also a professor here locally at the King's College, teaching this semester courses on classical philosophy, Plato, Aristotle, up to Aquinas, as well as a course on culture and aesthetics, of which where New York, of course, serves as a great presentation of both culture and aesthetics. I'm in love with New York as a city where you find the best and the worst of the human race, and it's a good combination to keep you alert and keep you from falling asleep with boredom. I'm married, I have 5 children, and by now 9 grandchildren. I have my son is still in university down at George Washington University, where he studies international relations with a concentration on Africa. And he spent the last year in Africa learning comprehensive Swahili and, of all things, Afrikaans. The series that is planned for these next 5 sessions is central to things that concern us as human beings. Central to our personally, central to the work that you are involved in, central to us as neighbors, one to the other, in that one world that we inhabit at this moment of history. Let me start with the definition. When we talk about danger in religion, it is not a denial of religion. Religion, in its original meaning, is related to the word related. Religion relates a person to the outside world, much the way the language your children learn at your home relates them to your way of thinking and doing. It enables them to copy you and to be understood, to share in your life, to give you joy, and occasionally also a bit of sorrow. But it's relating that is involved in the word religion. Religion relates people to one another. It relates people, this generation, to the preceding generation. It gathers in its understanding traditions that are passed on from one generation to another. It is also what relates us to visions and perspectives of the world around us, of how we see things. Religions are descriptions of what we notice in the world around us and how we understand that. It usually ties us to something bigger than ourselves, besides to people and traditions. And some would say to a transcendent power, a God who exists. Others would say to impersonal forces. And that's been the nature of the Marxist atheistic religion that tied all of history to the sweeping force of scientific progress and had nothing to do with God, but nevertheless had its own prophets, its own texts, and its own celebrations, its own memories, its own ways of celebrating the advancement of history. So religion ties people to something bigger than ourselves, because as we remember as children, we wonder, where did we come from? What are we here for? What do we do with the world that we experience? How do we classify impressions? How do we distinguish between right and wrong, life and death? Beneficial and harmful. And religions give us the key, as it were, through which we relate to these phenomena of an objective reality. Religion, in that sense, can give peace and order. I feel at home because others go along the same way. We classify slices of life in similar fashion. It gives a sense of cohesion. I am not alone in the world. But unhappily, it also can be the root of fanaticism, at the point at which we tend to exclude from our. It is okay to have different points of view when you are limited to a little valley and the mountains separate you from neighbors elsewhere. That worked well as long as we have tribal orientation in religion. Then indeed it serves a purpose of cohesion, of order, of the same language, the same symbols, the same traditions. However, in the one world that we now inhabit, where everything is interrelated, not just electronically or by travel facilities, but indeed where we recognize that we have a universal human race and not several races, countering the suggestion of Voltaire and much of European history to separate the human race into different ones, when in fact we now face one world with one human race, then religions need to be examined. We cannot just continue with what we have believed in our tribal region, in our little valley that we've inhabited, or in our national boundaries that we are proud of, or in the linguistic limitations that we're familiar with. The other day I was taking a subway, as I do every day, here in New York, and together with all the offerings about how to have your teeth whitened and the pimples removed, and how to improve your sexual performance, and how to learn another language, there was a quote by Schopenhauer, a German philosopher of the 19th century, that said, "Each man takes the limits of his field of vision for the limits of the world." Each man takes the limits of his field of vision for the limits of the world. It comes from a study on pessimism that Schopenhauer wrote. And as I read that, I found indeed that that is part of the problem that we face today across the universe, across this one human race, in this one interconnected world, that urges us precisely to transcend the limits of our visions, to take stock of what is common to all of us as human beings at this moment of history or any other moment of history. It's as if the valleys have opened up and we all live in the same playing field. And we must re-examine the field of our vision so that we would not take that as the limits of the world. The world is larger than any attempt to create an order for my group, for my tribe, for my traditions. Certainly, religions, as they tie people together and create a community of celebration, a community of rites of passage, of what you do when somebody dies, when somebody gets married, when a child is born, when somebody gets old, or whatever. What do you do? There's a certain security in knowing that this has always been done. But is that not most likely the limited vision of my group that I easily take for the limits of the real world? The real world is larger than that. And no faith can withstand the exposure to a larger reality than what I thought I knew. Daniel Borstein, one of America's wonderful historians, for many years director of the Library of Congress, university professor at the University of Chicago, said, "The greatest hindrance to knowledge is the belief that you already know. The greatest hindrance to knowledge is the belief you already know, and you don't need to look any further." Well, the one world that has opened up, especially you working at the UN in one form or another, face to face with others from different parts of the world, need to be free to indeed examine how large the world is, so that the limits of our field of vision is not the same as the limit of the real world. We may believe our vision is the accurate description of reality because that's what we are raised in. But we need to transcend that in light of additional information, other human beings, different ways of looking at things. After all, faith is not a good thing if it makes us believe things that are not accurate to the real world. For centuries, people believed the Earth was flat. It didn't make it flat in any way. For centuries, because it's Pythagoras and others, it's Marx and Lenin and so forth, believe that the human being is nothing but a compilation of material atoms that function driven by material context. It didn't do away with the fact that those under Marx's rule still had ideas that they expressed, emotions that they took seriously, wrote love letters which they hoped to be received precisely as communications and not just as physical necessities. Faith can be wrong, just like the flat earth was wrong. What people believe about the species of life itself needs to be constantly re-examined. What you believe about the nature of a woman, what your religion tells you about the life of children, whether you honor or dishonor manual work. What is the individual in the context of society, and do you allow him to speak up, no matter what his age or gender, are things that relate not to my faith, but to the real world. For, as I like to point out, there is not a single man amongst us who is not born from a woman. So how can the woman be inferior to the man? If a religion teaches that, there is something wrong with a religion. It's the wrong set of glasses, and all of us who have glasses from time to time need to correct our vision. Not correct the field out there. It's there. A man and a woman are there. What I need to adjust is the strength of my lens. What I have to remove is the shade, as sunglasses are now called. It is the reality that determines what I should believe, not the community, not what I've always believed, not my longing for security and acceptance. I have to live in the real world. And it is that real world that requires inquiry and must provide the answers. If, in fact, I only hold on to my faith, then I cannot be, I cannot really claim to be an honest person. I may be faithful to my tribal group, to my religion, but I am unfaithful to the real world. The real world does not change overnight. It is there in its facticity, in its objectivity, and I must adjust what I believe about it in light of the evidence that daily hits me in the face. I need to be free to question authority. That is, after all, what you do when you debate things, whether at the United Nations or in your government or around your dinner table, because we don't believe that we already know everything that there is to be known. And so to what extent does my religion allow the questioning of authority? Or is he who or she who maintains that religion authoritarian? Is he the author of it, as God claims to be, or is he a substitute for God that functions with a false authority and becomes authoritarian, as the Pharisees were at the time of Jesus, according to the scriptures? And as various groups in different other religious contexts affirm themselves to be have the final say? Or is, in fact, reality to be examined? Is it the author? Is that not part of what I need to deal with, I need to analyze, for which I need to adjust my glasses? I once, in many of my travels, I used to teach in the former Soviet Union. I worked with Food for the Hungry as an NGO in various countries in Asia, Africa, and South America, trying to teach what is specifically Christian about relief and development, more than just love, sharing, and compassion, but also ideas, because of the power of ideas to transform people's lives and habits. One of those trips, I was in Yoshkola, which is north of Kazan, in the forest area of central Russia. After my first lecture, we went out for lunch, and it was among school teachers and school administrators, and we went to a local school to have lunch, and there sat this man in his standard issue gray Soviet uniform of a teacher, an administrator, all by himself. I walked up to him, getting a translator, and inquired whether he enjoyed the lecture that morning, and he turned to me and he said, "I don't like religion." I grabbed his hand, I shook it vigorously and said, "I agree with you 100%. I don't like religion either. Look at what religion, intimidation, limited visions have produced in the various cultural contexts around the world that we are familiar with. Religion can be a tremendous hindrance to human development because it assumes that a certain practice, a certain vocabulary, certain habits of life are the final answer to the questions that reality itself raises. That kind of religion is tyrannical. It favors the collective. It favors either the collective obedience of everybody doing and saying the same thing, in which case the man was right. Religion is a hindrance to the development of each child, the practice of different work, jobs, the questioning of difficult situations from new angles. Or religion can lead to indifference, and that's why I gave the title to the book, Christianity versus Fatalistic Religions in the Battle Against Poverty. Because much of the poverty around the world is not a poverty of resources, it's a poverty of ideas. It's a poverty of human beings being allowed to take themselves seriously, to be in anguish over tragic situations and seeking ways to not repeat them. That same Daniel Boorstein, to which I referred earlier, also says that out of Christianity, and before that out of the Bible itself and Judaism back then, came an attitude of innovation, of doubt, of questioning and seeking improvements, while all other religions finally tell you to please be quiet, go along with everybody else, you're too stirred up. Do it again, what everybody else is doing. He calls it cultures of again and again. So then, what is the nature of that reality? What is inevitably present to all of us, to which we need to have real answers? What is that world, and how do I view it? Am I prepared to review my prescriptions for my glasses? Am I prepared to admit that possibly I also have become nearsighted? That reality consists of a definite universe, of a real space-time reality, of substances that are objectively there. You know, none of us can leave this room except through the doors, elevator or otherwise. There is a real world there, and it is logical. It is not mystical. It is coherent. It can be studied. Aristotle's insight into the details of reality is a tremendous help in that. He was not an ideologue the way Plato was. He dealt with the details of practical reality to which we are all exposed. What produces food? How do we get rain here? What happens when a person has a cough? How can we improve that? Why does this car break down? Etc. It's all questions about an objective reality, a reality of things, of a cause and effect context. The second, of course, is the wonder of human beings, that we're not finally reducible to biological phenomena. We have a world of ideas. We dream, we imagine, we question. We use language not only to communicate, but also to create propaganda, unhappily, sometimes. We write love letters because we put particular value into the words that we want to use to convince somebody else of the affection we feel for them. And the human being is also able to use language to tell lies, to squash people's minds. But that's the human being. Willard Galen, in his book Pinocchio, or Being and Becoming Human, describes it so well that the human being is in no way like an animal other than in his biology and in his genetic structure, how genes work on the development of a person. But a person is not an animal. We use language, an animal uses sounds. We make love, an animal has sexual generation, etc. There are differences that are profound. And it's how do you see people, individual human beings? What is your outlook on that? And then down the road, what on earth is life that we struggle for? All of us do that. We complain when we ache. We go to doctors when we're ill. We seek advice when we're lonely, when we're damaged, or whatever, because life matters so much to us. And if that is so important, then how do we explain the phenomenon of death, that rude, crude interruption of everything you've striven to do? Is it just the turning of the wheel, or is it something outrageous, upsetting, and something to be opposed? After all, that's why we do go to the doctor, because we don't just say, oh, it's interesting what these viruses do to us. We make a moral judgment in favor of life and against death. How large is that world? Is there indeed one human race or many? It is the wickedness of Voltaire and others who laid the foundation for the study of several races, which of course immediately leads to the assumption that one is better than the others. And the tragedy of the last 250 years of racism practiced is enormous and extremely difficult to overcome and to deal with. What do we see in this reality? How do we understand it? It seems to me that that's the starting point where we have to begin, not with religion, that shallowing of a complex reality by defining it according to our traditional local perspectives. But rather, we have to deal with a larger reality of and raise questions concerning its origin, its purpose, its reality, and its moral, the requirement of moral decisions in it, in order to favor, celebrate that which we have discovered, or the wonder of human existence in the real world. It is here where it seems to me Christianity, the Bible, gives an answer that is an answer that appeals to the mind, that is true to the real world, and that favors the life of each individual person. According to the Bible, the infidel is not killed. According to the Bible, Adam and Eve can walk out of the presence of God, and God protects Cain, telling him to watch out, because sin is crouching at your door. You better fight against it, but he is not destroyed. It is according to the Bible that God emphasizes the value of each individual person, whether he's a believer or not a believer. The God of the Bible pleads with us to come to know him with intelligence, with minds sharply alert, inviting us to question how come the Bible can talk about a good God in such a messy world such as ours. And it gives, to my limited understanding, the only possible explanation that indeed tells me that I am not in error to lament the present condition of the human world, of the world we live in and the human race. It is not the way God wanted it to be. It turned sour at the fall. This is not God's doing. It does not meet God's approval. It is for that reason that he ran after Adam. When Adam hid in shame because he had sinned and walked away from God, and he thinks, now I've done it, it's finished, God runs after him and says, where are you? He says, stop fighting, you man and wife, because Adam immediately in Genesis accuses God of having made Eve, and she gave me of the fruit, and it's really your fault. And God says, you can't get on this way. You've got to stop that. And you've got to put your hand to the plow, because nature is no longer going to be your friend in every area. You have to control it, impose on it human standards of life against the indifference of a nature that merely functions like a gigantic biological machine. And then they would die, it says, because death was the consequence of their transgression, as Scripture tells us. But they were told precisely to have babies so that the human race would not die out. They would set a new generation of people against the reality of their own death. And the promise of the Savior, the Messiah, the woman that would one day give birth to Christ, to God's way of dealing with the problem of a broken world, would only be possible if, in fact, Adam and Eve did have babies, and they would have babies, and one day there would be a woman who would give birth to the one anointed by God to be the Savior. That's the Bible's description. It's wonderful to see in Abraham a person who believed precisely that God is not contained in the Babylonian sun and moon worship. He's not contained in the Baal and Ishtar worship of the pagan fertility cults. He's not contained in creation. He is rather a God who addresses us with words to our mind so that we can understand. He addresses us with language that can be questioned. He presents himself not subject to or not calling for blind obedience, but he is a God that can be argued with, as Jeremiah did, as Job did, as Jesus did, as Moses did, again and again. How come, God, that you are good and this is a messy world? What do we do about it? It is in Christianity where you find the roots, basically, of an open-mindedness, of a curiosity, of a fundamental desire to understand where we've come from, who we are, and what we are to do. Out of Christianity comes precisely an anti-fatalistic encouragement to create a life, to seek peace, to seek justice, to walk humbly with God, to love my enemy, and to forgive those who really seek to be forgiven, and to create together something that resembles more closely that which God intended there to be, in the expectation that one day when Christ comes back, all things will be made whole and complete again. It is this that is so radically different from religions, which I do think are often very, very dangerous, because they intimidate. They do precisely the opposite. They are tyrannical in the sense that the doubt and questioning that is so central to Christianity and Judaism, the constant argument in the Knesset or the constant argument in a democratic form of government, or the constant argument between teachers and students, or between husbands and wives,
In order for us to be sharper, more perceptive, to be more realistic about life itself, comes directly out of the kind of things that the Bible talks about. It's the very opposite from blind humility, from a piety that has nothing to do with the cruelty of life, that somehow denies it. The whole European history with its monastic orders is an exemplification of an effort by Christians precisely to create islands of sanity in a world of insanity. When Rome collapsed, when the pagan European tribes in the 6th and 7th century roamed all over Europe, raping, pillaging, and destroying. After all, one of the tribes was called the Vandals, and that's where our word vandalism comes from, you know. And in that context of behavior, the monasteries set themselves up as islands of sanity in which they not only protected the text to copy it so it would be precisely handed over to the next generation, but they also practiced medicine. Many of the French liqueurs, as a basis, have the search for herbal medicine in an alcoholized fashion because that's the only way you could keep them before refrigeration. That's where hospitality was practiced in an otherwise insecure landscape. That's where commerce was favored as the church watched over the accuracy of measurements, not prices, because prices go up and down with supply and demand, as you all know, but the accuracy of measurements, that a kilo would be a kilo and not less and not more. With the establishment of guilds that would watch that there would be quality control over what would be offered in the markets. In order to produce something of wholeness, favoring human activity, intellectual and practical, and health-wise, in a society that needed to be reconstructed. That's beneficial result of religion. The other, the tyrannical imposition of certain patterns of life, of certain rules and certain attitudes, is indeed a great danger. So I shook the man's hand and I said, I agree with you. And that's why when I talk about Christianity, I don't talk about it as a religion. I talk about it as either true to the real world or false. And if it's false, then I would be the first to fight against it. And if it's true, then we all need to reconsider, indeed, the question that we all had when we were children, and why do we so easily stop asking it? Where do I come from? What's the world like? And what's the point of it all? Thank you for your attention.
Please give. Yeah. We're going to make it a regular feature of these sessions during this series that we want you to feel free to question, after all. We just put that forward as one of the high values of true religion. So that's what we're going to do now, and this is an open forum, and so please, Professor Middleman, are you ready to field your comments and questions?
Please feel free to object, to question, to pursue. I noticed you've all finished lunch, so you don't have any tomatoes to throw. But if I've said anything objectionable or so, please feel free to respond. I've done that all my life. It doesn't hurt me. It doesn't injure me. You don't take anything away from me as a person when you disagree. So please feel free to. Yes, ma'am.
Issues of religion, Christianity, and all the fates, the gods or the goddess or certain animals, that's their belief. They believe that and they hold that to be true. And I believe Jesus Christ, I hold him to be the risen, crucified, the risen child of the living God. I don't know how, yes, the statement, faith is not so usually the wrong thing, but my faith, what I believe in, is different from someone who believes that maybe their life lies in the hands of maybe like Muhammad. So, how do, that's I'm stuck there on a wall. I don't know how.
Yeah.
Get around that statement.
Yeah, and the way you state it so well, in my experience, so often produces an immediate counter reaction. You have no right, that's your faith, etc. And so I find it helpful to leave that aside and talk about the things that we do have in common, the common reality, and then build the case for my belief in the risen Christ in a context in which it is more accessible, more sensible. It doesn't come across as a brusque rejection or a judgment, in judgment implied, of course, on me, you fool, why don't you, kind of thing. Just like the person who believes in the flat earth, I take out to the ocean and make him look at that, at the horizon, it's curved, it couldn't be flat. Or you take the boat out and eventually you'll come back the other side, as the discoverers that we know of in Europe, and I know there have been discoverers in China before and so forth and so on, but as they found out, the earth is indeed round. So the evidence, let the evidence speak rather than let my faith speak. And so, in a sense, before, I personally find in that kind of a context, that it's not helpful to talk about what I believe concerning Jesus Christ. Let's start with a common. What do you believe about human beings? What do you believe about the real world? What do you believe about, how do you explain the difference between the human person and everything else? Because philosophically there's never been an explanation given of how the reality of personality, freedom, derived sovereignty, I can choose and do something, how that can come out of a scientific, permanent cause and effect system. How can freedom come out of obligation? Or a closed, how can an open system come out of a closed system? There must have been a God. There must be a God. That God must not be just some indifferent personal power, but he must be someone. And the Bible tells me that. And so does the Quran. It tells me there is a God there. And then I have to find out what kind of a God, and so forth and so on. And gradually build, as it were, the context within which my faith is justified. It doesn't hang in air, or it doesn't just root in my heart. It's not in my tradition. I don't come from a Christian background. I became a Christian when I was studying law, in a context in which I all of a sudden realized that law is a rubbery substance. In a democracy, it is always changeable. All we need is an election of another majority, a different government, and it becomes and it's a control mechanism that's very necessary, very useful, but it is unpredictable in the sense that tomorrow can be changed. And then I realized that if I'm a lawyer or a judge and I would sentence somebody to prison or to a fine at a certain date, that law which I use to justify my judgment can be changed, and the poor sucker, I can never get him back his years he sat in prison. What right do I have to determine this is wrong when in fact the majority tomorrow decided it's perfectly right? And so my question was, is there anything in the universe that's fixed, unchanging? And yes, there are some scientific things. Water always runs downhill. The English have a wonderful saying, you cannot have your cake and eat it as well. There are things that are fixed, wonderful. What else is fixed? Well, what's fixed is that I'm a person and not an animal. I make choices. I want to be taken seriously. One of the things I used to say in Russia, because they did talk about Christianity and they wanted it because they wanted to go back to the pre-Marxist cultural context, and I basically said, look, we're not talking about religion. We're talking about the fact that if you want to trade with the West, if you want to understand our museums, if you want to understand our educational principles, you have to understand the significant result that Christianity has produced, because you don't have the portrait galleries of the Frick Museum here, or in the Met, or the Tate in London, or whatever. The emphasis on individual people, not only, but also. You don't have that anywhere except in Christianity, where the individual person matters, and therefore, if he's accomplished something, let him be painted. We had a very funny experience the other day in the Frick Gallery. We were looking at Rembrandt's self-portrait as an old man, and this lady comes by and she says, looks at one painting, she moves over to Rembrandt and says, oh, that's a Rembrandt. I never liked Rembrandt. He's so dark, and moved on. You know, but it's a portrait of a person. You cannot understand it except from an understanding of the biblical realization that God has made human beings, and therefore each person is valuable. Not each person is good, but each person is valuable. So I would talk about the real world, what it looks like. And then point out that what I believe is in accordance with that real world, not because I see it that way, but because the real world doesn't allow me to see it in any other way without doing violence to my experience, to my eyesight, to my evidence. So, yes, my father was controller of UNICEF for 10 years, here in New York. He was first director in the Near East, regional director for UNICEF from Cyprus to Iran to Somalia and everything in between. They traveled widely and so forth, and we were participating in that. And he says, I know so many people who are not Christians and they're wonderful people. And I say, there's no doubt about that. But when somebody says the woman is inferior to the man, or the woman is there to serve the man and so forth, there's something culturally appealing. I can do a study on it. I can write a doctoral thesis about it. I can admire the faithfulness of text to practice, but it does violence to the woman. It's often does violence to the woman, and there's something wrong there. My father would say, oh, but that's their religion. And I would say, yes, but religion needs to be tested in the fire of reality. The problem is we do it the other way around. So, going back to the Marxists, in Russia, I used to say, you know, if in fact human behavior is controlled by the material circumstances in which a person lives, why do you have a mind control police? Why are you so afraid of people's ideas? Why don't you just feed them more spinach? You know, why don't you give them enough food, enough warmth in the house, enough music in their ear, and then they will be good Soviets? They constantly had to fight against the reality that their definition of the human being was not accurate. The human being is creative, witty, charming, wicked, you know, all kinds of things. That's what a human being is. And whatever I believe about them has to correspond to that. And as a human being, I need to be open to review. As, you know, you find, for instance, Job in the Bible, who says, you know, the things I suffer raise questions about the goodness of God. And he says, where are you? My friends tell me I'm a wicked man to ask that question, but I can't but ask the question. And then God at the end shows up and says, you're right, your friends were not your friends. They were misrepresenting me. So, yes, you know, initially it's I believe this, and I think that kind of conversation should stimulate us to review. Why do I say what I believe? Not the emphasis is not on saying, because you should say it, but why do I say I believe this rather than something else should make me think through what are the reasons. So, if I may just add one thing, you know, do people sometimes ask, do you ever have doubts? And I say, yeah, I do. And then I start all the way back at creation. What is the possible explanation for the reality of human beings and a mechanical universe? Sorry. Yes, sir.
Yeah, thank you very much and for this excellent presentation. I was very much impressed by what you have said, especially by the approach, but maybe trying to sum it up in my turn. It's a concept of religion that is actually a sort of adventure you open to the reality and to avoid any temptation, I would say, to limit myself in my prejudices, in my emotions, I would say concepts that make me feel much more comfortable sometimes, because I share some ideas with my fellow compatriots. I think it's a very challenging perspective, but I'm really very much impressed by that. My question would be, would you believe that at the same time, the religion or our faiths and beliefs tend to be based sometimes on emotions, on inherited traditions, experience, unconsciously possibly inherited. So that's why it's very difficult actually to fight all this stuff what we might not be even conscious about. And that's why this dialogue between different religions might be so, I would say, explosive, because people can easily, you know, hurt others' emotions, not something what is rational, what is based on ideas, but what is based on feelings. So that's why it might be so difficult. As you know, we in the United Nations, we have to meet with each other, with different backgrounds, different beliefs, and the issue of how people should respect other beliefs, other religions, has become an issue, obviously. So from your perspective, what would be your, I would say, recommendation, if I may say so, to really open up the, in practical ways, you know, the base of communications? I very much share your, I would say, perspective. Let's talk the real world. Let's get rid of these prejudices and all this stuff, but it's very difficult at the same time. So, and what might be as well the sort of role of the, especially in Christianity, the religion is based on a structure, the church that has been building on several, I would say, fundamentals like the dogmas in the Christian yeah. The Middle Ages, stuff like that. So, to keep this very complex stuff, from my point of view, as simple as it could be, what would be the role of these structures that exist, like the church, like you know, congregations or all the organizations with gained experience to really open up this communication in the global flat world? That there are no valleys anymore, there are no boundaries we can hide behind, but we have to really to talk to each other. And once again, I really admired your presentation. I think the concept of religion is a sort of courage to really talk about real world. It's I think, very much encouraging, but in my view, it's very difficult.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Well, of course, emotions are very much involved in it, but we must also realize that emotions also are dependent on what we had for breakfast and whether New York is humid or as it is now. And so it is something to respect, to value, because we're not machines, we are emotional beings, but also to be critical about and to try to find some distance sometimes to emotions, because you don't want to be, you don't want to choose your husband and wife on the basis of emotions alone, you know, though they play a part in our choices and so forth. The other thing, it seems to me, is that, you know, the structures with which we're familiar with, you refer to the church, congregation, et cetera, dogmas, statements and so forth. I look at them as, in a sense, the consequence or the conclusion I come to, not the starting point. You know, I belong to a church. I am a Christian. At the end of the current end of the road, as it were, But that doesn't mean that then I've stopped inquiry, curiosity, wondering how they came to these statements, what is implied, what's not implied. In fact, that's, if I may advance myself for a second, you know, that's why I wrote the other book, The Innocence of God, because there's so much in Christianity that I think has moved over towards a fatalistic view of God, that everything is under God's control, therefore everything is meant to be, etc., which I don't find the Bible's statement to be. So I belong to a particular denomination that where many, many, many people hold that view, but I oppose it. I argue for it. I write about it. I bring it up in my class with my students. I make them think about it. I remember once, a number of years ago, when I was teaching in a college, some girl held that view, and I said, I will never hire you as a babysitter for my son, because if he chokes on a spaghetti while you watch him, you won't do anything about it. You'll say it's the will of God. And you become an unreliable babysitter. I want somebody who gets upset, you know, who does something about it. And so you know, the dogmas of the church, the congregation of the church and so forth is the end result for the time being in the realization that no human society, including the church, is ever perfect. You know, read for those of you who read the Bible from time to time, you know, read all the New Testament epistles, Paul, Peter, James, and Jude, writing to congregations that are in a mess. Isn't that surprising? There is no ideal church. There is no, you know, Protestants say the Pope is wrong because why should he, and so forth. And the Protestants fail to see that they may have 6,000 popes that they listen to, as if they were the popes. You know, and we're not. We believe on the basis of good and sufficient reasons. This Dr. Schaefer, whom you referred to, used to say, there's only one reason to be a Christian, and that is it's the truth of the universe. Not that it's helpful to me, not that I feel good about it, not that I, at the end of the day, I've got to join something. It's rather, it's the truth of the universe. And that's something you arrive at while at the same time keeping an open mind, because we haven't seen tomorrow yet. It's just like you're taking your airplanes to go home to your countries. You know, you count on the pilot, on the machinery, on the air controllers, and so forth, all doing their best job, but you hold your breath. It's not fatalism, it's just reality. And so you believe the pilot. He'll get you there. And hopefully, you know, he'll do his best. So that to me is where we are with faith. In a sense, all our knowledge of anything in the universe is faith knowledge. You know, the scientist looks through the microscope and believes that it gives him an accurate reading. He doesn't know the way God would know, if there's a God, which I believe. But he, you know, all the evidence is in one direction, and so far, nothing against it. Therefore, I can believe that. Therefore, I can join that congregation. Therefore, I can see, yes, these doctrinal statements, they're pretty good summary. Probably could be improved on, but they're pretty good summary. Just like, you know, when you were younger and decided to get married, you looked at each other, you talked to each other, you found each other in different contexts of each one in their own family and saw how they related to your siblings and to your parents, did you respect them, and so forth and so on. And then you decided, there's good reasons to get married. But you don't know what marriage was like. You know, it's all knowledge, it's faith knowledge in that sense. But faith is not opposed to sense, evidence, evaluation, continued openness to review.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Dr. Mittelman.
Thank you.
And thanks for those excellent, thoughtful questions. We'll continue next week. And 2 weeks from now, 22nd October, ideas have consequences. Sir, did you have a statement?
Uh-huh.
Thank you. And I think that rather than giving Professor Middleman the chance to respond, since we have to give all of you the freedom to go to your 3 o'clock meetings, what you've done very nicely, thank you, is set the stage for what he only, I think, today simply prepared in an overarching way what we're going to be discussing for the next several sessions. And it will get more practical. And as I said, the book that I'm recommending talks about the alleviation of poverty and fighting poverty in a very real world. That ideas make a difference. And what are those that work and what are those that don't? So the basic question, what really works in the world of today, touched on in various ways today. And by the way, I think he'll be able to stay for a few more minutes. So if you really want to get a direct shot at Dr. Middleman, do you have you have a 4 o'clock class, don't you? Yeah. No, he has to rush away to the university, so he won't be able to hang around. But that, as I said, that is, I think, where we're going for the next four sessions. We will be going there, getting very practical, and I invite you all to come back if you can shake yourselves free during the lunch hour 2 weeks from now for the next in the series. What consequences does our thinking have? So thank you all for coming. If you want to pick up a daily bread, David has some. There's a paper by Dr. Middleman entitled "The Worldview for the Nations," which you may find stimulating, which elaborates a little bit more on some of the material particularly that he touched on toward the end of his lecture. And the books, yes. The books. The Innocence of God, to which he referred at the end, and Christianity versus Fatalistic Religions in the War Against Poverty. David will help you with that. They will be $20. Yeah, each. All right, thank you for your patience, and I know some of you have to rush away. I hope that your mind at least has been stretched just a little bit to think more deeply about what faith is all about.